Happy Sabbath, everybody. Welcome, January 5, 2013. What a blessed time to be here. We'll see if the speaker works here in a moment. My presentation is entitled today, Why Earth? I suppose I could have said, Why on Earth? It would also apply. But as you know, I'm big on creation. I'm big on evolution, the fallacies of it, of course. And so it's just my genre. I'll change eventually when I run out of material. But first, we have to ask a very important question, and that is, are you special? Now, I know Larry's special. Well, I've missed him. Haven't we all missed Larry and his wife? Okay, so at least we know two people here are extremely special. The rest of us, we won't worry about right now. But those two are especially special, okay? We have indeed missed you. Great to see you back. Second question, of course, which directly relates to the first one, is Earth special? Yeah. Well, maybe. And there's a lot of people who would argue that it's not special. Silly people, I understand, but nonetheless, we have to understand their arguments to be able to call them silly people. Otherwise, we speak in ignorance, and we don't want to do that. So we want to know that these are indeed silly people, based on evidence. So we're going to start off things with a little video, and then we'll get into the crux of the message.
Hurtling through space, we quickly pass the orbit of Mars in just 4 minutes, 30 seconds. We continue on, past Jupiter and the other gas giant planets. Saturn. Five hours and 30 minutes after leaving the Earth, we fly past Pluto and its companion moon.
Okay. Now, I don't read that yet. Video, obviously, is a little bit daunting. Scales of magnitude, well, look, we can't even get past 16 trillion right now. I don't know if you noticed, though, but it was only 25 trillion miles to the nearest star. Okay? So if we started stacking up dollars, we're more than halfway there. Folks, these are some crazy numbers. They're simply ludicrous numbers. But in all those stars and all those galaxies, you have to begs the question, are we special? Clearly from this, there's bound to be another Earth out there somewhere with little monkeys crawling all over it. There's just gotta be, right? Well, you know, the argument is out there and has been for some time that indeed there must be. However, there's some issues with that argument, which we're about to encroach upon. I threw this in only because of the Torah study. And it's a complete tangent, and it will waste only valuable time, which we don't have. Nonetheless, we will do it. This is an entirely different presentation, but I just had to throw it in there. That's why I'm not going to say anything about it, because I'm going to lead you on for another presentation. Okay, so, moving on. In long, slow-motion movements of immense majesty, there emerges a sparkling blue and white jewel. It takes more than a moment to fully realize this is Earth, home. Edgar Mitchell, an astronaut. 1800 years, man essentially believed in the geocentric model. Aristotle, Ptolemy taught this, basically in a nutshell, that Earth was in the middle, the sun and the planets moved around us. A little bit more than that, though, that Earth was motionless. It just sat there. Now, and also, plane geometry, if you're big into math like I am, and if you're not, that's okay. For those, there are some people who really love the Bible who look at these people and say, well, that's just silly because of geometry. The funny thing, though, is in plane geometry, the geocentric model does work mathematically. It does. That's how the Egyptians built pyramids. That's how everything on Earth was built. They used plane geometry. Okay? However, by using plane geometry, they were not able to accurately describe and explain why planets and the moon did what they did. That's where the math started breaking down. But the math worked just fine on Earth. It's when you got off the Earth that mathematical formulas, those formulas started breaking down. And that's why we had an issue with the planet rotations and things like that. Okay? But I just want to bring this out because people, you know, look back at these people and they say, well, those fools, clearly this is not right. And yet it is. The math does work. It just doesn't work off-planet. Okay? We and Earth are just an accident. Carl Sagan, boo. Anyway, believe there are millions of Earths out there just like ours. And I had to put in there because accidents happen all the time. They must be right. I mean, when we drive down the street today, there's bound to be an accident. Surely, from that video with all those billions of stars, surely there must be another Earth with little critters hopping all around it, right? I mean, mathematically, you would have to say clearly there's a statistical possibility for that to occur. Well, let's see what the math has to say. We already did that. All right. One thing to remember in that video, and this is so hard to wrap our heads around, whenever you hear light year, what do you instinctively think? Time. Light year is not time. Light year is distance. I wish they hadn't called it a light year, because light year screams time, but it's not. A light year is distance. distance, distance. Whenever you hear anyone say light year, you have to physically remember he is not talking about time. He is talking about distance. And it's hard to wrap our heads around this because our entire paradigm is based upon light year being time, and it's not. Light year is distance, which changes everything. When something is 10 light years away, it doesn't take 10 billion years for the light to get here. The distance to that star is 10 billion light year, or 10 light years, for example. That's the distance that light can travel in a year based on 186,000 feet per second. Okay? So it's distance, 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 not time, time, time. And when you start reworking that through in your thinking process, the galaxy's not that big. Oh, I mean, it's huge. Don't get me wrong. It's 100,000 light years across. But as far as the time required for things to happen is completely different than the measurement of a light year. So anyway, just always put that in the back of your head. When you hear light year, we're talking distance, not time. And it starts to change the way we see things. Are we on just a pale blue dot? This was a book that Carl Sagan wrote back in, 1980s. Okay. The argument is, of course, that there's nothing special about Earth. After Aristotle and Ptolemy came a guy named Copernicus, okay? And he figured out a few things. 1543, he was a Polish astronomer. He thought, rather, that the Earth was not in the center, but rather the sun. 400 years later, though, his principle has de-evolved into something. And it's evolved into a situation where Earth is no longer special. Rather, it's just hanging out there in the middle of space. And what's interesting about this is Newton, Copernicus, name all the big guys you know, Einstein, the older ones, they all believed in Scripture. See, they use math and science to prove Scripture. And of course, they don't say that in the school books. These guys spent time in the heavens and in math to prove what Scripture was saying. And essentially, they did. Theory of motion of planets in the sky, but it devolved into the principle of mediocrity, which is essentially that we're not special. Okay? That the universe was not designed for us. And Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan says, our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. Now, that sounds fairly negative to me. Interestingly enough, everything in Scripture is positive. About creation, about the handiworks, about the framework, about string theory. Oh, that's another presentation, by the way. He's really down on it, down that day. You know, we're just floating around. Kind of sad to be those people at times, isn't it? Just no hope. Edwin Hubble. We know of the Hubble telescope. It's not his, of course, but named after him. This is him, though, back in the 20s. From Earth, he had a really big telescope, too, just sat on the planet. Hubble saw these individual galaxies. 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, that's ours. And so this argument about us not being special started to come about when Hubble started seeing some things. Before Hubble started seeing some specks in the night sky, many thought that we were on the edge of the universe and nothing else was really out there. Now that's really kind of an interesting statement, and I'll show you why it's interesting in a little bit. And if I forget to tell you, don't worry about it. Are we special? This is what Hubble saw in the 1920s, 1930s. See those little specks? Okay? Now, if we saw those on a piece of paper or up on the wall, what might you say those are?
Little specks.
Little specks. A dirty telescope lens. Or stars. Right? Well, what Hubble realized after a little bit more investigation that what he was seeing were not individual stars, but individual galaxies. What kind of changed some thinking? Holy moly! So even with the technology back then, we could see these things, and with a little math, which was no longer planar geometry, but some also theories that Einstein brought up, we started seeing the universe in a completely different fashion. They were originally thought to be packets of large pockets of gas, but they're galaxies. The universe is populated by innumerable Earths and perhaps innumerable forms of life, so says this fella. Okay, so this goes back to the same argument. Statistically, with all these stars, all these galaxies, surely there has to be another Earth with little monkeys crawling all over it. Mars Exploration Rover. And we've heard this for years. If we just find water on Mars, we'll know that aliens flew us to Earth. Or we drifted amongst space gas and dust, and seeds were planted on Earth, and poof, after 4 billion, 8 billion, 12 billion years, there was little bacteria crawling all over the ground. It's projected, because obviously no one has counted, so we use math to do these things, 10,000 billion, billion star systems. All right, well, you know, we don't even understand 16 trillion, so this is just silly to even bring up. It's a lot. Oh, we have found, by the way, more than 100 planets. Isn't that spectacular? We've found more than 100 planets. Guess how many look like Earth, act like Earth, remotely compared to Earth? Zero. Now, I understand. Well, that's only 100. Surely there's a billion more. True. But we're going to find that it probably won't matter that much. It takes a lot of factors for a functional Earth. If you remember back to the DNA, you probably do, I'm sure, where we had proteins, left-handed proteins and right-handed proteins, and they all had to fold the right way, and that protein was only left-handed, and then you had other things that only could be right-handed. There were a lot of factors, right, for just a simple protein to be made. And you had thousands of proteins making up a molecule, okay? The Earth is no different. You see, we need a little bit more than just water. Another interesting thing that we often forget about because we don't think about it, because no one said it. The laws of physics apply in our solar system, in our galaxy, also appear to apply throughout the most distant galaxies. Okay, the universe is part of the entire of the same framework. What's that mean? It means that the law of gravity, the way it works here in Earth for our sun, in our solar system, applies to our galaxy and also applies to other galaxies. Okay, so we don't have rules changing. The first and second law of thermodynamics applies, gravity, light, all these things apply in other galaxies. So we can make some mathematical computations based on that, right? Okay. In other words, if gravity worked here in one way on Earth and it worked a different way on the moon, we'd really be in a situation here. But they're not. They are consistent. Location, location, location. Who wants to buy a house? You have to have the right location, otherwise you wouldn't want to buy the house, right? Well, guess what? This is the sun in the center. This is what we call the circumstellar habitable zone, the blue ring of life. And lo and behold, this is where Earth is. Okay? Now, you say, okay, it's great that you put a blue ring on the screen, but what does that blue ring mean? All right? Well, if we were outside of this ring, like closer to the sun, we'd be like Venus and Mercury, which life cannot exist upon. If we're outside this blue ring, we would be like Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Pluto, Neptune, places that can't sustain life. So we know, based on hard scientific evidence, that there's only one place that we could survive in our very own solar system. Too close is not good, and too far away is not good. There's only one spot to be. And we just happen to be right within that spot, that band, that ring. Location is crucial. Okay. Now, we must have liquid water for life. We're going to bounce around with water because it's so much fun. So, of course, we understand that if we were closer to the sun, we wouldn't have any water because it would all evaporate. And if we were farther away from the sun, it would be all frozen. Does either one of those support the idea of life would thrive? Of course, we can scientifically say, no, it doesn't. If we were just 5% closer, and I grant you this is on a solar system scale, so we're not talking 50 miles, we're talking 5%. But if we were 5% closer, then we'd be about 900 degrees like Venus. That's just 5%, okay? In the scale of the solar system, 5% is not that much, okay? Now, 5% increase in taxes is a different thing entirely. But 5% in the solar system is not that much. If we were 20% farther away, now you might, fine, you go 5% and then 20%, what's the deal here? Well, it's a band of blue. We do have a little bit of leeway within this band, okay? So, but if we're about 20% farther away, then we start to go outside this blue ring and we become icy cold, okay? Recipe for life. We talked about this before in DNA and genetics, so I'm also going to apply it here because it works so well. What Copernicus came up with was eventually devolved and polluted into this Copernican principle. And in a nutshell, they just simply started saying, well, if we can just find water, we're well on our way. And that's why that's what the big hoo-ha about Mars is. If we can just find ice water there, then we know that that's a great spot to start. Okay? Well, okay, I guess you can make water your first priority for checking out. But there's a few other things we need to have in place to make it work. Okay. So, for those who want to believe in this simplistic principle, all we need is a little water and an accident, and we have life. I would argue that, no, generally when we have a little bit of water and a little bit of time and an accident, we get exactly what we expected to get. A puddle. All right, so let's go back to this. Add water. True, water is the key to life for carbon-based life forms, which we are. We are carbon-based life form. We're not silicone-based life form. We are carbon-based. It is a universal solvent, and that's incredibly helpful. It transfers nutrients. It hinged on the distance from the sun. In other words, too close, it evaporates. Too far away, it ices up on us. Ice floats, which is interesting. Water is such an amazing thing. I wonder who came up with the idea. Oh, I remember. Okay, now it makes sense. We all know that ice floats. Just remember what would happen if it didn't. Imagine if ice sank instead of floated, right? The oceans would freeze from the bottom up. They could never thaw. Instead, ice floats and acts as an insulator so that the water underneath does not freeze and kill all the fish. Ice is one of the few elements that does that. Almost everything else that freezes sinks. Strange that the most important thing we have on the planet doesn't work that way like many other things. It's insulation. It can easily be converted to a vapor for easy transport. We understand this. Three phases, we can go from ice to water to vapor, backwards, in and out, and the water molecule never deteriorates, devolves, or stops working. It always comes back to its original form, which is fairly helpful. And an unmatched capacity to absorb heat from the sun. I was going to do an experiment, but I just ran out of time. We'll have to wait for string theory. All right, another piece of the recipe. How do you like your crust? Stuffed, thick, or thin? All right. Our crust, 4 to 30 miles thick. If it was much thicker, our tectonic plates couldn't shift. I understand people in California don't like the tectonic plate shifting. I get that, but it's also necessary. They are in constant motion. They help regulate the internal iron core temperature of Earth. They recycle carbon, and they mix chemical elements together. So there's a lot going down there that we can't see from up here, but there's a reason for it. I think so. It at least shows things working as they're supposed to. All right. Magnetic field. We need a magnetic field to survive. Okay? So another piece of our recipe. Our iron core is what generates the magnetic field. If it were a smaller planet, okay, then we'd have a weaker magnetic field, which This is solar wind radiation coming off the sun. If our magnetic field was a little bit smaller, a little bit weaker, then solar rays would strip away our atmosphere, which we'll come to here in a second. If we had too strong of a magnetic field, your compass would point north and never do anything else helpful. Of course, that's what it's supposed to do. But one thing to remember is that everything we see up here is finely tuned. In other words, if this wasn't just right, it wouldn't work well for us. If ice sank instead of floated, water wouldn't be very helpful for us. So everything we see here is just right. And that's why I worked with kids last week. So if they came home and started saying, "just right," that's my fault. Okay? Because everything we see here has to be just right, or it won't work. Many of us bake or cook, things like that. I love garlic, but if you put a little bit too much in, you can ruin whatever you're making. Lemonade, if you put in too much sugar, it's not quite as tasty. Put in too much lemon, it's... Now, you can find people who like it too sugary and too lemony. But for the grand source of people, they want it what? Just right. Our atmosphere, we're going to add just a pinch of it. Not too much, otherwise this isn't going to work at all. About 78% nitrogen, 21% oxygen, 1% carbon dioxide. See, it's important to have carbon dioxide up there. Otherwise, this would not work. Interestingly enough, it's less than 1% of the diameter of Earth. If we had too much carbon dioxide, we could have a hazy atmosphere like one of the moon, Titan moons. And we'll see a few other examples. Such as Neptune, Saturn, Jupiter, Venus, they all have high carbon dioxide in their atmospheres, hazy, can't see through it, which might be slightly important. You see, if we had a hazy atmosphere, we wouldn't be able to see the stars. So we could just throw out a bunch of scriptures because, you know, Abraham be sitting down there looking up at the haze. He wouldn't have been able to write half the things he wrote. David and Solomon, they wouldn't be able to write hardly anything. Job, get rid of all of his scriptures, because they never would have been able to see the heavens and the stars. Let alone the sun. I mean, they might see a big glowing thing moving overhead, but beyond that, we wouldn't be able to see outside our window. We're going to need a dose of a large moon. Our moon is about a quarter the size of Earth. It helps stabilize our angle at approximately 23.5 degrees, for those who want to know. It also moves the water on Earth. And there was a... Oh, it just came into my head and it just leaked out. It's coming. Patrick McManus. He was a... He's since died, but he used to write funny camping stories. I grew up reading his books. Make you laugh. You know, the bear ate Goomba. They shoot canoes, don't they? You know, real ponies don't fly. Things like that. Anyway, he was in a canoe one day with a little kid who helped move rocks for him in his front yard and then move him back to the backyard and then move him back to the front yard. Anyway, one day he took this kid, teenager, fishing. And anyway, the discussion came up about tides. And Patrick McManus asked the kid, "Well, you know why we have high tide and low tide, don't you?" The kid said, "Uh-huh. Good, just check him. And you know it's the moon, right?" "The moon? Are you crazy, man?" Okay. It's the moon. It literally pulls the water. It tries to pull the water off Earth. Fortunately for us, we have surface tension in water, and we also have just the right amount of gravity to not let that happen. Yeah, ironically, the moon's gravity is just right so that it can, one, spin around us and make those high and low tides work to circulate our ocean water, which helps regulate our temperature, which helps regulate our weather patterns, which helps make everything go round and round. So if our moon was a little bit smaller, it wouldn't have the gravitational pull to move our water. If it was a little bit farther away, it wouldn't be able to work properly. And if it was too close, it would rip the water right off the earth. And so you see, it has to be just right. Can't leave out the sun. The sun is fairly important here. We have a spectral style G2 dwarf star. And that's important. Because if it wasn't called that, we wouldn't be here right now. 90% of most other stars are smaller than our own, which means 10% are larger. Now, that's only interesting because if our sun was any smaller, it wouldn't have the gravitational pull to keep the solar system intact. And if it were any larger, it would suck us all in for a marshmallow roast. Well, the other neat thing would be is if it were a little bit larger, it would put us into synchronization with our orbit, which simply means we wouldn't be able to rotate. See, we rotate every day. Gives us morning, noon, and night. But if we were any closer, we'd be like the moon. See, the moon doesn't rotate around us. It goes around us, but it doesn't spin. That's why we have the dark side of the moon and the light side of the moon. We never see the dark side of the moon. If we were closer to the sun, we would also be doing the exact same thing. Of course, you see the dilemma there. One side is always baking, and the other side is always freezing. So you would have to literally live in the right spot. Location would certainly be important at that stage. You know. And it's probably unlikely that complex life would thrive in such an environment. I think that's... You don't have to go too far out on a limb to make that statement. More than that, we have to be in the correct location in the galaxy. If it wasn't bad enough in the solar system, now we got to be in the right space in the global neighborhood. Here are some things that are required, the recipe. We need to be within that galactic habitable zone. That's galactic, not the solar. We need to be orbiting the right star. We need to be protected by gas planets. We need to be within our solar blue band, if you remember. We need a nearly circular orbit. We need oxygen-rich atmosphere. We need the correct mass. We need a large moon. We need the right strength magnetic field. We need plate tectonics. We need correct ratio of liquid water and continents. It needs to be terrestrial planet. Can't be just solid iron. Moderate rate of rotation. Too fast of a rotation, not good. Too slow, not good. It has to be at one place at one time. So no, these things have to work together in unity, in harmony. And has to be properly measured and mixed in just the right order. Okay, so let's go to Vegas. All right. So let's imagine that formula. If we took all those things, and there are others, but those are the ones that I just could fill up on one screen. Let's take all the things that we know that we need, right? And let's put them into a formula because that's what we do. That's what math is. What might that formula look like? Okay, that's a pretty good formula. I won't attempt to explain each one, but each of these does represent one of those principles that we talked about. Okay? X is multiply, of course. So we know that in algebra, we use variables and words to replace large numbers. We use the pi symbol, so we don't have to do 3.14567895121. We use just simple pi symbol. The interesting thing about math is everybody on the planet understands it. That's another presentation. No. Meaning, you may not know what to do with it, but if I wrote out pi to Chinese, he'd know what that would represent. 3.14567. If I wrote out pi to a Russian, to a Canadian, to an American, we all know what pi represents. Math is a very, very interesting language because it means the same thing anywhere on Earth. But I digress. If we assign a conservative value, why do you say conservative? Well, let's be fair. It may not be just 1 to the 10th, okay, for some of these principles. It might be 1 to the 100th. It might be 1 to the 10,000th. But let's just keep the math simple, please, right? Let's just be conservative. Let's give it every opportunity to succeed by accident. So let's just do 1 to the 10th. Okay? That's our probability. That's a 1,000th trillionth of a trillion. Who wants to buy that ticket? Okay. If you remember statistics from the genetic class, we know that we are approaching the law of tank gonna happen. We might be rare, but we are certainly special. Solar eclipse. This isn't the actual solar eclipse photos from it, from northern India. It was a 51-second event. It is rare, but it does occur, and we can measure it and know when it's going to happen. And we can even know the best place on Earth to go and see it. Okay? You say, well, big deal. What's so special about a solar eclipse? It happens everywhere, doesn't it? What about a perfect solar eclipse? Does that happen? Everywhere? Anywhere? Well, there's a recipe for a perfect eclipse. The moon has to appear as a similar size of the sun, which ours does, by the way. Our sun is 400 times larger than the moon, but it's also 400 times farther away. Has to be a straight line. Guess what? That happens. We can do that. Well, we can't do that, but it happens here in our backyard. And what we discovered in the late 1800s, we just figured out a huge backyard experiment that showed us that something that we never would have found out without it. If we didn't have perfect solar eclipses, there's a huge piece of our scientific and mathematical knowledge would never exist and we wouldn't be able to prove. But because we have this happen, we're able to prove some mighty fantastic things, and I'll show you what. What can you do only with a perfect eclipse? This is a picture of eclipse. It's not normally blue. It's behind a filter. The reason why is we can see, right, the edge of the sun. You see, without a perfect solar eclipse, we can't measure sun. We can't measure our sun. We can't measure solar flares. We can't measure lots of things without a perfect solar eclipse. You see, if the moon is too small, then we get some of that bright light coming around the edge, right? So we can't measure it. If it's too big, the moon, then we don't see this around the outside edge. Lo and behold, ours is just right. To where when this happens, we were able to measure temperature, distance, a plethora of information about our sun that we would never be able to measure any other way. Only with a perfect solar eclipse could we gain this knowledge. Now, perhaps modern-day technology, perhaps that might be different. But this was discovered back in the 1860s. We can measure the sun's atmosphere. The other interesting thing, and this is what they found out in 1860, if I'm right, I know it was late 1800s, what we call the flash spectrum. They never saw it except during a solar eclipse, and it was by accident. This is the flash spectrum right there. Through a prism, okay? We've played with prisms and bent light, and we could see the rainbow, right? Okay? Well, this was discovered during a solar eclipse. We didn't know it existed until this occurred. And you say, well, that's pretty cool. Well, what's it mean? Well, that perfect solar eclipse, we were able to prove something right here. May 29, 1919. Well, don't read that. Look at this red line. This is the sun. This is light from a distant star. And it seems to be bent. According to Einstein's theories, he theorized that light would bend from the gravitational pull of our sun. Now, if I, even when I say that, that just sounds silly. I got light coming from a distant star. It's passing by our sun, and you're claiming that the gravitational pull of the sun will bend the light. Now, how are you going to prove that? Guess what? With a solar eclipse, we got the information we needed to prove Einstein's theory was correct. Gravity does bend light. Give that to your 8-year-old in public school and have him tell that to his science teacher and see what he gets. I can bend light with gravity. He'll be laughed out of the school until he brings some mathematical formulas back and some pictures of solar eclipses and some measurements. Now you say, well, what's the big deal? What's the big deal? It changes the way we understand light and time. You see, if light doesn't just go straight, it can do other things. If I can bend something, I can do other things with it. I can increase time or I can decrease time. If I change gravitational pull, I can change things. I can change the way things appear, and I can change how fast they fly by. You ever hear about the Apollo rocket when they went to the moon? Called the slingshot? They slingshot themselves around the moon to get back to Earth. That's just silly. Who would slingshot themselves around the moon to get back to Earth? That doesn't even make sense. No, you put on the brakes, you turn around, and you go back, right? I mean, that's logical. Maybe logical, but it's not mathematical. And so by understanding...
That's gravity, right?
That's gravity. Light years distance.
Light years is distance. And so it's kind of
that's one of these things.
And that's how it's important about the bending of the light rays, because you can play with time.
That's right. It also goes into the age of the universe, but that's an entirely different presentation. But let me just say, if we can bend light with gravity, imagine what a lot of gravity would do. Think about that tonight. Here's that flash spectrum. Any of you who know the Hulk know about gamma radiation and the poor thing that did to that green guy? We know about X-rays, because you don't want too many of them. Ultraviolet, too much, and you turn pink. We have invisible, that's what this is. We have infrared, we get to cook our food with that. Microwave, we do the same thing. And radio, crank it up. But the flash spectrum is the only portion that we can see. We don't see any of the other ones. Again, we might say, well, okay, that's helpful information. What do I do with it? This narrow light spectrum, that's what makes photosynthesis work. You see, plants can't live and do their thing with gamma radiation. And they can't do it in the microwave either. But this little narrow piece, and I'll show you just how narrow it is in just a moment, it also shows us how things work in the entire universe. It is just right. Another thing to remember, this goes to string theory, but that's another presentation entirely. You have to remember that light is a frequency. You know the oscilloscopes, you see them on TV, the little wave going across? You have to remember one thing. It goes back to light, year, time, distance thing. That light is not light, it's a frequency. What can you do with frequencies? You can speed them up or you can slow them down. Right? Okay, so just remember that frequencies can change. And all you have to do is know how to do it. I can think of somebody who might know how to do that. Okay. This extremely narrow band, the flash spectrum, is 1/1,000,000,000th of a trillionth of the range of the electromagnetic dimensions. That's that whole band that we saw, from gamma radiation all the way to infrared microwave radio. Interestingly enough, our star, our sun, gives us just the right amount of the flash spectrum. You see, it doesn't give us just gamma radiation, otherwise we'd all be walking around like the Hulk, maybe. And it doesn't just send us radio signals, otherwise we would just be whistling a happy tune all the time. What it does is it gives us that narrow band, an abundance of it. Well, we need that for life on Earth. Too much radio, the plants don't live. Too much ultraviolet, we all cook. You see, it's just right. And this type of light is able to penetrate our atmosphere. So if we didn't have the right atmosphere, the right thickness of the right elements in the right place, then this wouldn't be able to get through. Or maybe gamma radiation would come through instead of the flash spectrum. There's our equation. You thought the other one was bad? Okay, this is the equation for the flash spectrum of that entire electromagnetic field. This is what the percentage is of that entire field, and that's what we get an abundance of through Earth. The only portion of that band is that much, and that's what we need to live. And that's exactly what we get from our sun. It's just right. It's not even just right, it's just right. Best place in the galaxy is right there to view other galaxies. Guess where we live? Here's our Milky Way. It's flat. Yeah, we know this. Spiral arms might be important. Spherical bulge in the center. I don't know why that's important. And we live about halfway from the center to the edge. Now you might say, again, okay, what's the big deal? Well, because we're not in the center and we're not on the outside edge. We're just right. And I'll tell you why that's important.
The situation is much more subtle. We live on a planet made out of iron, magnesium, and silicon, and oxygen. If we went in the more distant regions of our galaxy, out towards the outer edge, the abundances of these elements are low.
There probably aren't enough heavy elements to build Earth-sized planets that can support life. So there's a happy medium between the dangerous galactic planets
life is possible within the Milky Way, the Galactic Habitable Zone. Their theory was first published in 2001 and has since received growing acceptance among astrobiologists.
There's a lot more research that needs to be done to determine just how wide the habitable zone is, but I think there's general agreement that yes, there are definitely places in the galaxy that you cannot have civilizations because they're very dangerous.
These obstacles to habitability are minimized far from the core and edge of the Milky Way. Gonzalez has also identified large areas within the galactic habitable zone itself, which are less hospitable to complex life.
Even within the habitable zone in the galaxy, it's broken by the spiral arms, which are dangerous places. That's where most of the supernovae go off in the galaxy. That's where the star formation is taking place.
Okay, so you see, even in our own galaxy, we have to be just in the right spot. You see, in the center of the galaxy, that big bulge, it's a big black hole. So we don't want to be there. That's just not good. All right. star concentration, black hole, lots of radiation in the middle. You know, it's just not a great place to be. Our area, again, another blue ring, obviously quite large. Iron, magnesium, silicon, oxygen. Okay, this is kind of interesting. I hadn't heard this before, but I checked out a few other newer sources, and sure enough, it still holds this to this day. But the argument is, based on our Earth's construction, iron core, etc., we have heavy elements, things like that. From what they've been able to ascertain, they're just not as plentiful out there. So, again, we're just in the right spot. So, you know, God came down and scooped up the materials that were right there, packed them into a little ball, and there it was. Okay, spiral arms. So, as best we can tell, and this is accurate information. This is math, backed by math and astronomy, and all best we from star constellations. This is where we can determine where we actually are. We are there, and if you zoom in a little bit, there's us. Now, yeah, this is the galaxy. This is the Milky Way galaxy. These are the spiral arms. This is between the spiral arms, and that's where our solar system is. We don't have time.
Surrounded by gaseous planets.
Mm-hmm.
So we also have to have the other planets.
They make the argument that the large gaseous planets help protect us from, you know, incoming meteors and things like that. Such as
Saturn, Jupiter.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, anything outside of Mars is a gas planet.
Okay, but what about Pluto? I've heard in the last several years that they've downgraded.
Well, he's still out there. He's just a moon. He's just a rock floating through space. But he's still there. We covered that. Now, again, the argument. Okay, so what's the big deal? The big deal is, with our perfect beachfront property location in the galaxy, we can see the rest of the galaxy and the universe. Well, not the entire universe, I understand. But we have a window in which, between those arms, we can see outside the window. So not only can we see outside our front window from Earth, we can open up the back window and see what's out there. If we were anywhere else, we wouldn't be able to do that. Well, you know, if we weren't just in the right spot. Okay, if we live closer to one of the arms, that's what it might look like when we looked out the back window. Okay? Which means all those other galactic clusters, the other star constellations, they no longer exist to us anymore. Because that's all we would see. You see, we're just right. The most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. Albert Einstein. Everything we discover about the universe and galaxies and math and science and astronomy, lo and behold, we're able to understand that information. You see, we can measure stuff and we understand what it means. Where else might that happen? I'm going to skip some of this. Here's just a short little 90-second. Imagine there was a machine that controlled all of these laws.
Show physical constants. If you change even slightly from its current setting, the strength of any one of these fundamental forces, such as gravity, the impact on complex life,
of properties in underlying physics that seem to be prerequisites for
they made a, I didn't put it in here, but if you took all of the laws that we know about thermodynamics, gravity, light, etc., in their equation forms, you could basically take every law that we know about and put it on one piece of paper. And there's your explanation of the universe on a single piece of paper. Copernicus, you know the guy's theory who got messed up? He wrote, "The mechanism of the universe wrought for us by a supremely good and orderly creator, the system, the best and most orderly artist of all, framed for our sake." And I'm going to skip that. Conclusion is next. All I can say is Genesis 1:1. Let's start at the beginning. Interestingly enough, Job recognized that the earth hung on nothing. Remember, if he couldn't see out the back window, he wouldn't have known such things. Movements of the constellations were known only to God. Well, that's probably true. But we also know the movements of constellations. Not all of them, of course.
They're very predictable.
They are. We can mathematically tell you exactly when they'll happen. Comets. Halley's Comet. We know exactly when they're coming by. And as soon as they get out of our visual range, we don't see them again for 80 years. But we know exactly when they're going to come back. The question is, will you be here to see it or not? So, conclusion, see? We are special. We are privileged. And we live in just the right spot.